Cambridge Breakfast with Julian Clover and Lucy Milazzo.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Humanist celebrants in Cambridge are supporting a landmark challenge of the High Court, which could see humanist weddings in England and Wales have the same legal status as religious or civil weddings. The hearing in the High Court is a test case which has been brought by six couples. It's taking place today and tomorrow, and if successful, the UK government will be forced to recognise humanist weddings as legally recognised marriages, and that's the same as religious weddings and humanist weddings in Scotland and Northern Ireland. Vanessa Corbishley is a humanist celebrant based in Cambridge. She joins me now. Good morning, Vanessa.
Good morning, Julian.
Thank you very much for joining us. So how did humanist weddings end up being recognised in Scotland and Northern Ireland, but not in England?
Because I'm afraid we all have different legal systems, and while in Scotland they took action to legalise humanist ceremonies in 2005, England and Wales have not followed suit. But Northern Ireland, they changed the law in 2017, so they've had legal humanist weddings there for 3 years, and also in the Channel Islands in Jersey and Guernsey in 2017 as well. So we're playing catch-up.
This does seem to be a bit of a difference. I remember during the sort of the height of the coronavirus outbreak with the press conferences, you know, you were sort of got your best information by tuning into the Scottish press conference at lunchtime, because there was a reasonable chance and it would be released in the UK and in England a few days later. But the distance you're talking here in terms of time of a good 10 years with Scotland, at least, did people nip up to Scotland Gretna Green style in order to have a humanist wedding?
They certainly do, yes. I mean, Scotland, quite a lot of humanist ceremonies are conducted outdoors, and Scotland has such beautiful scenery and lovely locations for weddings that many people are drawn to go over the border. And the fact that their humanist wedding ceremony can be legally recognised there is a great draw to them. In fact, in Scotland at the moment, there are more humanist weddings conducted than there are any other kind of ceremony. They're just growing in popularity all the time. And that is included by the fact that people come up from England to do it.
Do people identify as humanists, say, in the same way somebody might identify as Muslim or Catholic or Christian?
Some of us do, but a lot of people don't. A lot of people are living very decent, happy, fulfilled lives without any religious part in them at all, and they don't even realise that that kind of lifestyle has a label, the label which is humanism. And a lot of people come to it at significant points in their life when they are looking for some kind of celebration, be it a wedding or a funeral ceremony, and they come along and find out that these kind of ceremonies exist, and they say, oh yes, that's me, you know, that's who I am, and they kind of identify with the humanist label at that point.
How do you define humanism? You know, is it, I don't know, is it Christianity without a God, or is it closer to being, say, an atheist? Where on the sort of, I don't want to call it the religious spectrum, because you probably won't like me saying that, but where on the belief spectrum would you put humanism?
I'd call it a philosophical belief that the universe is a natural phenomenon. It rejects religious and supernatural views, but instead humanists trust scientific evidence and emphasises that humans are responsible for giving meaning and shape to their own lives. So we look to what's true and provable.
How many of you are there in Cambridge? You know, when the census comes around, will there be many ticking the box?
I can't tell you exactly for Cambridge, but nationally about 7% of people identify as humanist. And it's a group that's growing all the time. I would expect in Cambridge we might be a bit above the national average, actually. Mm.
So what would it mean if this case in the High Court today and tomorrow is successful? What would that mean to you? What would it mean to you personally?
Well, this is something that Humanist UK have been campaigning for over 20 years. So it would be a huge joy to me that the weddings that I conduct from now on would have legal recognition. At the moment, when celebrants like me conduct a wedding ceremony for a couple, we can have a beautiful personal ceremony that's tailored to their outlooks and their beliefs and their values. But at the moment, it's not recognised in the law. And so those couples also have to go to the registry office to do the legal part of the marriage ceremony. So if we get the change in the law, then the ceremony that we conduct would be legally recognised as well. And it would save all the hassle of couples having to have the extra expense and inconvenience of going to the registry office.
Yes, and I guess it takes maybe a slight amount of the joy out of it, really, for some couples at least.
Yes, because the registry office ceremony is very strictly controlled. There are very limited ways in which you can personalise it, and usually the couple have no relationship at all with the person conducting the ceremony. Whereas with the humanist wedding ceremony, the celebrant always spends a great deal of time getting to know the couple and really tailoring the ceremony to match them and their values and their outlook.
Now, that's interesting, because if somebody is getting married, say, in a Catholic church, they might go through wedding preparation classes. It kind mm-hmm. of feels what you're doing is a less formal, non-religious side to that. Is that the right interpretation?
Well, yes, it is a bit like that, yes. A humanist celebrant would always have, before the wedding ceremony, a series of meetings with the couple who are getting married so that we can really get to know all about them and make sure that the ceremony is fitting and personal for them and their values. People often include poetry and readings of their own choice, music, of course. They might want to involve friends and family in doing things like readings or performing live music. And it's always a very personal ceremony, very joyful, very much tailored to the couple concerned.
And because, obviously, humanism, there is no fixed building, presumably all of the marriages that you conduct are on location.
Yes, they are. All kinds of locations. Many of them are outdoors. Sometimes they're in people's homes and gardens. Sometimes they are in more hotels and golf courses and places where you might have a civil wedding. But then there are some very special ones that take place. I've conducted ceremonies in a brewery.
Brewery. Whereabouts in the brewery? Just in reception area, or do you have barrels in between and people pouring a pint if the sermon goes on for too long?
That was actually in St. Louis, Missouri, and was for my nephew David and his lovely wife Jonas, and they had a big room there, and we had a big function room, really, but okay. It had a bar at the back, obviously, and once the ceremony was completed, there was a whole range of different beers, and they were all there available for the guests to try, and it was wonderful. But people get married often in places that mean a lot to them, so family homes. I conducted one ceremony last year next to a stable full of horses, and when the bride arrived in her beautiful knee-length dress, she also had bridal Wellingtons on, which really kind of fitted in with the stable theme. She was a horsewoman, and everyone said how totally her that ceremony was, that she could get married in her Wellingtons next to her horses.
Fab. And how's business right now? Presumably, I don't think you can furlough a humanist celebrant, but one would have thought that many, many weddings would have been caught. Postponed, though. What's happening? Yes. Are people moving them on a few months, or how's it working?
Yes. Every wedding that I had in my diary for this year so far has been postponed. And most people are sort of putting them back to the same time next year. That's the general trend of things. I mean, it's very sad. People plan for weddings months and sometimes years in advance. And all that anticipation has been, swept away by the COVID thing. But people are being very sensible and pragmatic, and they are resetting another date and looking forward to the wedding as much as ever.
So you're facing a very busy 2021 by the sounds of things.
I think we are, yes, because all the couples that I should have married this year are going to get married in 2021. And then, of course, there'll be all the couples who intended to get married in 2021. So we'll have double the amount of weddings next year. So, yes, I'm expecting it to be a very busy time.
Yeah, that's put a lot of pressure on things for you. And I don't know, I guess legislation doesn't move quick enough, does it? So even if this High Court judgment goes in your favour and humanist weddings do become legally recognised in England and Wales, there'd still be a few more months to wait, presumably, before everything went through Parliament.
That's a little bit hard to give you a definite answer on. The legal mechanism already exists Parliament has already put in place the legislation that could make weddings humanist weddings legal. And so if this case goes in our favour, that switch could be flicked very quickly and humanist ceremonies could become legal in a matter of weeks, I believe. However, there's nothing to say that the government will move that quickly. You know, they have plenty of other distractions on their mind at the moment, not only COVID, but the whole coming out of Europe thing as well.
I've forgotten about that one.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they've got plenty to keep them busy. So it just depends. I understand that it would only take about an hour and a half of parliamentary time to flick that switch and activate humanist weddings to become legal. But quite when the government will find that hour and a half remains to be seen. We're hopeful. Yeah. We're always hopeful.
we shall see. I guess either sometime today or tomorrow that the High Court will give a ruling on that. Vanessa, thank you very much for joining us on Cambridge Breakfast this morning.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Vanessa Corbishley. She is a humanist celebrant based in Cambridge. On the roads this morning, it's pretty quiet. Back to normal. There were some issues around Clare in Suffolk and a few delays on the M11, but nothing really to report. Now it is 8:20.
Live and local.
Cambridge Breakfast.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
That's Sophie Ellis-Bextor at 9:09. It is Cambridge Breakfast from Cambridge 105 Radio. And this morning with Julian Clover. And the far-reaching effects of coronavirus has had a tragic effect on the businesses, suppliers and families who rely on a consistent, reliable food supply chain. The impact the pandemic has had on international trade and purchasing restrictions has caused cocoa prices to plummet 28% since the beginning of March, which is why on World Chocolate Day, which is today, the Co-op has announced it is reallocating £300,000 of funding to Fair Trade International and their Producer Relief Fund. The idea is to combat the effects of COVID-19 on the food sector and to help the most vulnerable farmers in the supply chain at risk of being pushed into poverty. I am joined on the line by Catherine Higgs, who is Head of Policy at the Co-op. Good morning, Catherine.
Hi, Julian. Thanks very much for having me on this morning.
You're very welcome indeed. Geographically, which sort of areas of the world are we talking about here?
I mean, when we're talking about cocoa, we're talking about countries like Peru, but most cocoa is grown in Ivory Coast and in Ghana.
Right.
But, you know...
So the COVID-19 pandemic, how particularly has that affected farmers at the end of the supply chain? I must say that, you know, despite being a complete newsaholic, I've heard very little about that part of the world and how it's affecting those people growing, well, things like cocoa, which ultimately ends up in chocolate, which is something, of course, we all enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, farmers and growers around the world, like everybody else, have been really badly impacted by the pandemic, both at a personal level, but also changes to markets, access to markets, transport, etc., have all impacted on growers' incomes, which is obviously, a real challenge. But on World Cocoa Day, we really wanted to focus in on the plight of the smallholder farmer. And growers who, despite growing some of the world's most important crops like cocoa and tea and coffee, etc., are still some of the most vulnerable and least prepared for the disease in the world. They're now at risk of increased hunger and poverty. And like everybody else, just really worried about how they're going to feed their family and what the future holds for them.
And I guess, for people in the UK, it's the same scenario, really. The work has changed because you have to work in a different way, and people aren't necessarily going to want your product in the same way, or something else has happened further up the supply chain, which is that stops you getting product from A to B.
Yeah, I think what it really highlights is, that we are part of a global food system. It is a food chain. We talk about a food chain, but it really, really is. And it's all linked together. So a change here impacts, further down the supply chain and equally the other way around. I think what's special about smallholder growers is, if you think about them, they're quite often their family groups. You know, they are farming on quite inaccessible and small plots of land. They don't have a lot of reserves. They are in countries where they don't frankly have, you know, access to medical equipment, hospitals, etc. And they are just, you know, really, really struggling. They've got no reserves, if you like, to kind of lean back on to support them when times are hard.
Mm. And the product that this affects, are we talking the big brand chocolates, or the ones where we see when we go to our co-op or whatever is our store of choice, and we see the little fair trade logo on the side of the packet? Is it particularly those which are impacted?
I mean, it's the cocoa market is the whole cocoa market, which serves, you know, fair trade growers, but it also serves the brands as well.
And presumably, ultimately, this puts up the prices for those of us who like our chocolate, be it a bit of Kit Kat or just a bar of good old fashioned dairy milk. That's going to ultimately, you know, put a few pence on, isn't it? Which is going to add up, and in return, that's not going to help the farmers anymore either.
I think the real challenge at the moment is, you know, is actually at the grower end.
Right.
There is a lot of, you know, there's a lot of product on the market in the UK at the moment. We're not seeing any shortages in products. I think what we're actually seeing is that the crops that the farmers have picked at the moment, they are struggling to get them to market. So the impact is really being felt at a grower level at
the
moment.
Does that mean we get a delayed
result?
Sorry to interrupt there, Catherine. Does it mean we get some sort of delayed effect where, you know, we might see the impact? You know, they're suffering right now, and obviously, you know, a few pence on a chocolate bar is nothing compared to what they're going through. But is this something which we're likely to see in a few months down the line?
Potentially, but I think, you know, I think we're quite shielded from it, and I wouldn't see that, you know, UK consumer prices would go up on the back of this, because I think the market will rectify itself. I think what we're focusing in at the moment is a real kind of humanitarian problem that is right now with growers who just at the moment can't access the market and are really, really struggling.
Okay, so what's the co-op doing here in order to try and help?
Yeah, well, so you know, I think one of the key things that we're doing, and I mentioned it already, is, you know, is backing fair trade completely. So fair trade is one of the only, well, is the only certification scheme that focuses in on price. It sets a minimum and it provides a premium for farmers to invest in their communities and build things like hospitals, schools, you know, invest where they like, really. You know, as a co-op, we're looking at how we can impact on growers and producers globally, and we're wrapping all of that together in a charter. So that includes our focus, as I've said, on fair trade, but also something that, you know, I'm really proud of and I'm very fortunate to know quite a lot about is our partnership with the One Foundation to make sure that everybody has access to clean, safe water. And all of our funding that would be going through to the One Foundation this half year, the donations that are created when people go into co-op stores and buy a bottle of water, is going to support communities in sub-Saharan Africa, some £600,000 worth of funding, to enable them to access clean, safe water. If you can imagine, put yourself in the position of a farmer or a grower at the moment, you're told that the best thing you can do is wash your hands. If you don't have access to water, then you are really in a really dire situation. So that's something that we're really pushing on. And as well as that, we're also thinking about our growers and producers everywhere in the world, you know, including the UK. And we're investing in our ethical trade program and providing training and resources for our suppliers to make sure that they can kind of safely operate, you know, in their farm or in their factory, and make sure that they understand how best to work in a very difficult environment with social distancing, etc. So lots of things going on together.
It's an interesting hour. This could potentially be the subject of a whole other interview, really. But when your buyers go out and decide, the suppliers of coffee, the suppliers of chocolate, the suppliers, I don't know, washing powder, is there almost like a checklist of making sure that, you know, you're not inadvertently going off and supporting, well, shall we say, dubious practices, you know, where you really do try to make sure that the people right at the other end of the chain are looked after?
Absolutely. It's a core principle for us. and is embedded in, you know, in how we act as a cooperative. Making sure that everybody that produces Co-op food gets a fair deal is absolutely core. And you're right, you know, when we go and investigate new suppliers and when we work with existing suppliers, you know, absolutely core to that is making sure that everybody's human rights are respected up and down that supply chain. It's not easy. It's, you know, it's a very complicated supply chain, as you probably know. Yeah,
and I'm sure people have tried to pull the wool over your eyes at some time to maybe, you know, try and push something through which isn't exactly what it seems. I'm sure your people are wise to that.
You know, we're really fortunate in that we've got long-term relationships with lots of kind of suppliers that we've worked with for a long time. So, you know, we've got, you know, absolute trust with those suppliers. But I can, you know, I can't speak for elsewhere in other supply chains, but, you know, we're, people are only human and, you know, these things do happen. But, you know, I'm really confident in the Co-op supply chain.
Yeah, no, certainly the Wellbeing Charter sounds a very, very interesting project. Where do people go to get more information on that?
Well, it's really easy to find out more about it. Just go on to the Co-op website, so co-op.co.uk. or go on our social channels to find out more about what we're doing around fair trade, around our ethical trade programme, and around all the work that we're doing to get clean, safe water to everybody.
Okay, that's very interesting. Catherine, thank you very much for joining us this morning. That's Catherine Higgs, who is Head of Policy at the Co-op. That takes us to 19 after 9.
Live and local.
Cambridge Breakfast.
Cambridge 105 Radio.